This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. On today's program, late and considerably more expensive. Serious concerns about the deal to build Australia's new submarine fleet. And how a shortage of females is affecting normally monogamous relationships with endangered parrots on Tasmania's Bruny Island.
They, you know, vigorously court the females by feeding them, and they press them constantly for sex. They make a real nuisance of themselves. Eventually these females just give up and they mate with them.
There have been dramatic scenes in the British Parliament overnight as a five-day debate begins before a final vote on the draft Brexit deal with Brussels. For the first time in British history, the government has been found in contempt of Parliament for failing to table the full legal advice on the deal. Here's how that vote happened.
Order!
Order!
The ayes to the right, 311. The noes to the left, 293.
Oh! Look at them! Look at them!
The ayes to the right, 311. The noes to the left, 293. So the ayes have it. The ayes have it. Unlocked.
I spoke with our Europe correspondent, Linton Besser, a short time ago.
Well, we've seen dramatic scenes here in the House of Commons. The background to this is last month, the House of Commons passed a resolution that the full set of legal advice underpinning Theresa May's Brexit deal had to be tendered to the House, tabled and published in full, in order that everybody had the opportunity to go through it and cast their vote in that full knowledge next Tuesday in the binding vote on whether to ratify this deal. But yesterday, the Attorney General declined to publish the full McCoy, if you like, and instead provided a kind of summary document. Well, that wasn't good enough for the Labor opposition. It wasn't good enough for some backbenchers. And instead, they've attacked the government and they've won a vote, narrowly, but they've won, putting the government in contempt of Parliament. It could mean that some senior ministers, the Attorney General, for instance, might be penalised and might have to miss some you know, critical votes in coming days, including the key vote next Tuesday, Sabra.
And I guess this is not how Theresa May imagined today would pan out.
No, not at all. She wanted to set the agenda, to come forward to the dispatch box and set out her persuasive arguments as to why this is the only deal that will achieve Brexit and not damage the British economy. But it has turned instead into a fiery debate. She's come kind of wounded, if you like, by this contempt finding. And although she has said we have to move on from this corrosive politics and kind of charge forward with our destiny in our hands, she's been beset by arguments on all sides, even from her own side. Here's a little bit of what her former foreign minister, Boris Johnson, had to say a short time ago.
After 2 years of negotiation, as has already been said, I think it has achieved an extraordinary thing in the sense that it has brought us together, finally. It has brought us together in the sense that Remainers and Leavers, myself, Tony Blair, we are united. The whole Johnson family is united in the belief that this is I'm afraid, a national humiliation that makes a mockery of Brexit.
And Linton, the final vote is actually scheduled for next Tuesday. Which way is that likely to fall now? And what happens if it fails?
If the vote goes down, and it looks like it will, we're in uncharted territory. We could see a move towards a second referendum on the Brexit deal, the fine detail. We could see a move of no confidence against Theresa May, but we don't know that that would succeed either. She might try and return to Brussels to get a better deal. There could be another election. The whole thing is completely up in the air. The only thing I think that is quite clear, Sabra, is that it increases exponentially, if the vote goes down, the prospect of Britain crashing out of the European Union with no deal whatsoever.
And that's our Europe correspondent, Linton Besser. The first of Australia's new submarines could arrive late and cost substantially more than expected as Defence works to finalise the $50 billion project. AM can reveal details of recent high-stakes negotiations in which the French company building the future fleet demanded price increases and a delayed delivery date. Defence correspondent Andrew Green has this exclusive report.
On the sidelines of last weekend's G20 summit in Argentina, Prime Minister Scott Morrison met French President Emmanuel Macron to discuss the yet-to-be-signed strategic partnering agreement which will guide Australia's future submarine program.
I'm very pleased about how that's progressing. It's a huge project. It's important for both countries for the next 50 years. And so we're getting very close to finalising that arrangement.
In 2016, French company Naval Group won a competitive evaluation process to build Australia's 12 new submarines. But now AM can reveal the secret details of recent commercial negotiations to finalise the $50 billion project. Senior sources have confirmed that in an effort to clinch a deal, Defence made an unprecedented offer to the French to grant them an extra 2 years and 25% increase in costs for delivery of the first submarines, but this was initially rejected by the company. Instead, Naval Group pushed for a 3-year scheduled delay and for an allowance of a 30% increase in delivery costs, but it later backed down from the request. Dr. Andrew Davies is a leading defence analyst.
The biggest concern I have is that we've entered into a sole source arrangement long before we had the information required to make a sensible evaluation of how much it's going to cost, how long it's going to take, and what ultimately is going to be delivered.
Defence says it's not appropriate to comment on the confidential discussions, but in a statement, the department has told AM it's in the final stages of negotiations on the strategic partnering agreement. Dr. Andrew Davies again.
If an agreement is reached in the near future, that's a good thing, but the devil's in the details. How much will it cost? When will the submarines be delivered?
AM can also reveal a former senior bureaucrat was recently hired in a bid to break the deadlock between Defence and Naval Group. Defence says its former Deputy Secretary, Kim Gillis, who left the department earlier this year, was engaged during November to resolve remaining commercial issues.
That's our defence correspondent Andrew Green. And a short time ago, the defence minister, Christopher Pyne, rejected the story in an interview on Sky News.
Well, the story is completely false. And Andrew Green has been grievously misled at the ABC. There is nothing true about that story. And the fact that the ABC did not come to my office...
So no cost blowout, no delay?
There's zero cost blowout and absolutely no delay as part of the negotiations for the strategic partnering agreement or for the submarine project.
Defence Minister Christopher Pyne. After weeks of a bare-knuckle political fight, the major parties have reached an agreement to pass controversial laws through federal parliament, allowing police and intelligence agencies to monitor encrypted communications. Under the deal, only state anti-corruption commissions will be excluded from the new laws. Labor says the bill is far from perfect. The government has agreed that they'll be reviewed in 12 months. Alastair McGibbon is the National Cybersecurity Advisor for the federal government and the head of the Australian Cybersecurity Centre. He joined me earlier. Good morning and welcome to AM.
Good morning, Sabra.
How will these laws make Australia safer?
Well, in many respects, what these laws do is help restore the authorities and powers that police have had all along. They've been able to intercept telecommunications since 1979 lawfully. But in the last several years, they've been, what they say, going blind or going deaf because of encryption, the use of modern technologies. What this law does is help codify a conversation between police and technology companies. It has to be reasonable, has to be proportionate, has to be technically feasible, but it's to work with those companies to help fight crime.
Does it make it safer?
Look, I think it does. What it does is give a tool back to law enforcement agencies and security agencies that they've been losing over the last several years. And again, all of this stuff is done under warrant. Some of the commentary over the last couple of months has surprised me. You need to have a telecommunications interception warrant. You need to have a listening device. You need to have a search warrant. These are the, frankly, quite civil liberty breaching authorities that law enforcement agencies have today. What it's doing is allowing those warrants to work in a modern society.
Once the law is passed, how soon can authorities actually use these powers?
Well, I would expect there'd be agencies, once the laws come into effect, that would start exploring what this means. I don't think you're going to have a rush of dozens of agencies at the door of big tech companies, but what I do think it will have is reasonable discussions between, frankly, often US-based tech companies that for years have seen themselves beyond the reach, not just of our law, but our social expectations. And nothing in this is unreasonable. Nothing in this is building systemic weaknesses. That's one of the other arguments that's been put. This is about breaking encryption. The bill is rightfully called Access and Assistance. It's not called the Encryption Bill. It's not about breaking encryption. It's about helping agencies get access to and assistance from these tech companies.
All right. The government did argue that these laws needed to be passed this week in order to ensure that Australians were safe over the Christmas period. But under these laws, companies then have 28 days to respond to a request, meaning that if a request was made this Friday, for example, they could respond in early January, so not the Christmas period that the government argued for.
Sure. I'd expect that once this law is passed, once the Parliament of Australia, who represent the people of Australia, once that message is sent to these tech companies, that they would behave in the reasonable manner that I know they will. I was also part of new laws that helped regulate them when it came to their social media use and protection of children. And I found once that law was passed, those companies understood that that represented the will of the Australian people and the need for them to cooperate. And that's what I think these large tech companies will do.
It's world-first legislation. Labor's reluctantly agreed now to pass the laws, saying that they're far from perfect, and the government has noted that there will be a review in 12 months' time. Why shouldn't it pass when the parties are convinced that it's as good as it can be?
Well, Sabra, firstly, it's not world first. The UK actually has more onerous legislation, and yet most commentators seem to have overlooked that. So in the United Kingdom, they have much tougher laws here. Those tech companies, the sky hasn't fallen. People aren't rioting in the streets of the UK saying that their rights have been infringed. That is also a parliamentary democracy where people expect to be protected by the law so that their privacy and security is protected. But that doesn't mean that criminals should have their privacy and security protected. And that's what this law does. It is less onerous than the UK. Look, I'm not going to pass comment on the way in which this has played out politically, but what I would say, when you talk to agencies, good people who are there to protect the vast bulk of society against any infringement of their civil liberties, all they wanted was a tool that would give them the ability to work with tech companies in a reasonable and proportionate manner under the rule of law, warrant and other such things, to get the job done to help protect Australians.
All right. So Mark Rowley, the former Assistant Commissioner for the London Police, has told a conference here yesterday that often social media companies will take down offensive material and explicit material like bomb-making guides, but they don't pass those details on to authorities about this material. Have Australian authorities encountered this problem?
Well, absolutely. These tech companies sometimes have taken material down. And frankly, to give them their due, they're getting better at taking down some of this material. What they're not good at and what they've avoided over time is cooperating such that you can get the right information that's necessary. Now, what this does is codify a communication between police and security agencies and the tech companies so that we can start setting social expectations, the right type of information, the right type of cooperation from these companies, technologies that we rely upon today, but we don't want them to be used by criminals, and I think the public doesn't want them to be used by criminals either.
Why aren't they handing over this information?
Conflict of laws, there's the fact that they operate outside jurisdictions, and for a long time they've peddled, frankly, tech companies, this incorrect view that Australian law doesn't apply to them and that they're beyond the social expectations of any particular country. And I think over the last couple of years, you've seen G20, you've seen modern Western liberal democracies saying, no, that's fine, we want you to do your business, but we want you to do it in a way that protects the bulk of citizenry. And that's what we're seeing here. And frankly, as I say, G20 did this in Hamburg a year ago.
Alistair McGibbon, the National Cybersecurity Advisor, thank you very much for joining AM this morning.
Thanks, Sam.
A Chinese-born West Australian Labor MP has resigned his membership of two organisations with alleged affiliation to the Chinese Communist Party. The WA opposition rejects Pierre Yang's claim that his failure to declare the memberships was an oversight. The state's Premier, Mark McGowan, is standing by him. Eliza Borello reports.
Pierre Yang commenced his term as a Labor member of WA's upper house in May 2017.
I, Pierre Shuai Yang, swear by Almighty God I will faithfully serve the people of Western Australia.
But until August 2017, he remained a voluntary legal advisor to two Chinese organisations, the Northeast China Federation and the Association of Great China. The former head of Chinese studies at Curtin University, Catherine Young, has told the ABC she believes these organisations have ties to China's Communist Party. She says the Northeast China Federation is affiliated with the United Front Work Department, a Communist Party agency promoting China's political interests overseas. And Ms. Young says the Association of Great China signed a letter supporting China's claim of sovereignty in the South China Sea. Mr. Yang has remained a member of both organisations until now, but failed to declare them on his parliamentary register of interests. After a story published by News Corp yesterday about his memberships, Mr. Yang has now cancelled them. In a statement, he said, "I overlooked including them on my returns," adding, "I'm a proud Australian citizen. My allegiance is to Australia." The WA opposition leader, Mike Nahan, says Mr. Yang must make a statement to Parliament explaining himself.
He said it was overlooked. It's hard to think that those were overlooked. It's okay to overlook a bowling club, but not one of those associations.
Jerry Groot, a senior lecturer in Chinese studies at the University of Adelaide, agrees transparency is important.
Every Chinese person who gets involved in politics in Australia has to be aware that there's interest in them from the United Front Work Department and from other elements of the Chinese government, and that they need to be as transparent as possible with their membership of associations.
WA's Defence Issues Minister, Paul Papalia, had not read News Corp's story when asked about it by reporters on Tuesday, but has defended Mr. Yang's character.
Pierre Yang is an excellent Member of Parliament. He's an Army Reserve officer. He's a lawyer. He's high-achieving Western Australian.
Mr. Yang also says while he was listed as a voluntary legal advisor, he did not do legal work for either of the organisations in question. The WA Premier, Mark McGowan, is standing by him, saying he's a valued member of his team who has his full confidence.
Eliza Borello reporting. You're listening to AM, where it's 16 minutes past 8. US senators briefed on the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi say they're certain the Saudi crown prince was involved. Here's Washington correspondent Zoe Daniel.
"Maybe he did, maybe he didn't," Donald Trump said when asked if MBS or Saudi crown prince Mohammed bin Salman ordered the murder of journalist and critic Jamal Khashoggi inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in October. After being briefed by the head of the CIA, senators say he did. Senator Bob Corker.
"If the Crown Prince went in front of a jury, he would be convicted in 30 minutes.
And Senator Lindsey Graham.
"You have to be willfully blind not to come to the conclusion that this was orchestrated and organized by people under the command of MBS and that he was intricately involved in the demise of Mr. Khashoggi."
The Saudi royal family and MBS have denied ordering the murder of Khashoggi, but evidence released by Turkey, including video of a 15-member Saudi hit squad linked to the Crown Prince coming and going from the scene, and a CIA investigation, have senators convinced otherwise. The Trump administration has chosen to point to the lack of a smoking gun in order to keep its relationship with Saudi Arabia and its broader Middle East strategy intact. That's to do with its anti-Iran stance, desire to protect weapons sales and keeping oil prices low. Bob Corker.
"MBS killed a journalist. We know he killed a journalist. And that is not acceptable per American standards."
And Lindsey Graham.
"Saudi Arabia is a strategic ally, and the relationship is worth saving, but not at all cost. We'll do more damage to our standing in the world and our national security by ignoring MBS than dealing with him."
Lindsey Graham's calling for global sanctions on those responsible, including the Crown Prince, and says he won't continue to support billions in US arms sales to the Saudis, at least not while MBS is in charge. In Washington, this is Zoe Daniel for AM.
Consumer and tenancy rights groups around the country say Australians who rent live in fear of eviction or rental increases and need a better structure of rights to protect them. The collective, including Consumer Body Choice and the National Association of Tenant Organisations, has written a report which finds more than half of tenants are currently living in a home in need of repairs. The report will be released at Federal Parliament today. Rachel Mealy reports.
Jen came home one day late last year to find all the trees in her backyard had been cut down. When she raised an objection and told the landlord that this made a significant difference to the livability of her unit, things got nasty.
It felt like I had no rights at all. You still feel like no one gives a rat's about you.
Jen had been in the three-bedroom unit in Rochdale, south of Brisbane, for 4 years and was paying $330 a week. When she raised the objection, the landlord issued her with a no-grounds eviction. She chose to move out before the eviction was enacted because the relationship had soured so much it was causing great stress. She's 56 years old and says her future is now uncertain.
Maybe I will become one of those statistics and a homeless person because I don't know what will happen now.
Penny Carr is the CEO of Tenants Queensland. She says Jen's experience is replayed in rental homes across the country.
I think there's a range of things that renters put up with, and the underlying fear, of course, in the majority of people is that they'll get evicted if they push too strongly to enforce some other rights that they might have. So, for example, people might need or want repairs to be done to the property, and sometimes they might ask for those to be done, but if they're not done, they won't push for them because they're fearful that if they do, they'll end up having to move. So there's a social and economic and a physical and emotional cost to moving, which people are reluctant to do unless they really have to.
The tenancy and consumer rights groups that have put the report together are calling for changes to laws in most states which allow landlords to evict tenants without the need to provide reasons.
What we want to do is to get rid of that ability to evict people without grounds, because what it does, there may be some good grounds in there that people are being asked to leave for, but you never know because you're not given a ground. But what it also does is to mask a whole bunch of discriminatory and retaliatory grounds.
Consumer group Choice is adding its voice to the argument. Erin Turner says laws to protect retail consumers have improved over time, but housing has been left behind.
We have fought hard to make sure that if something goes wrong with a product, whether that be a $1 loaf of bread or a more expensive car, that you can get a fair fix, that you can make a complaint and you know that you'll be heard. That is not happening in the rental market.
That's Erin Turner from Choice, ending that report from Rachel Mealy. Revelations of possible criminal behaviour that emerged at the Financial Services Royal Commission continue to shock many Australians, but the evidence of widespread misconduct is no surprise to Gary Weaven, who's just retired as chairman of the $107 billion industry funds manager IFM Investors. While the sector is waiting on Commissioner Kenneth Haynes' final report due early next year, Gary Weaven doesn't expect criminal or civil prosecutions, despite the fees for no service scandal where even dead people were billed. The man dubbed the godfather of superannuation is speaking here with senior business correspondent Peter Ryan.
Most of it was no surprise to us in the industry superannuation movement. We've been calling out the problem of corrupted sales commissions in financial advice for, well, in my case, 25 or 30 years. But the big takeout from our point of view is that this put real public recognition on the relatively good performance of industry super funds. So this is some sort of official endorsement of that, if you like.
Given the number of times a potential criminal breaches was mentioned during the Royal Commission, do you think that it's possible that there might be a civil or even criminal referrals to the Commonwealth DPP in Kenneth Haynes' final report?
Those revelations about continued illegal behaviour, they did surprise me. The rest of it didn't, but it did surprise me that there were some ongoing illegal activities in some of those retail institutions.
Would you be surprised if there were criminal prosecutions out of the Royal Commission?
It would, frankly, surprise me, yes.
So you'd be surprised if we did see criminal prosecutions, but would you expect at the very least civil prosecutions against institutions?
Look, I've seen some absolutely terrible corporate behaviour in my many, many years and outside of the finance industry. And in most cases, the law doesn't seem to have been up to correcting that in a really fulsome way. So 9-10 years ago, we had a global financial crisis, and there were remarkably few prosecutions of anyone coming out of that.
A few weeks ago, the Treasurer, Josh Frydenberg, said there would be additional funds for the Commonwealth Director of Public Prosecutions in anticipation of prosecution. So do you agree that there is an expectation that there will be that type of consequences out of the Royal Commission?
I think there's high consequences because some companies, it is very difficult in the retail space to see what their business model will be going forward. I think the big banks may well be in the process of divesting their wealth management or superannuation businesses. The coalition surely will be forced to stop its crusade against trying to weaken the industry super fund model. Clearly, there will be recognition of the representative trustee system, and that system works well, and that system does use independent experts wherever it's needed.
Has the Royal Commission been a catalyst for a major shake-up right across the whole super sector?
It has, to the extent that really what we've had is a very long period of futile and very wasteful bickering and combat with successive coalition governments instead of working out how we can improve the system, because there can, of course, be improvements made.
The corporate regulator ASIC came in for a lot of criticism for being asleep at the wheel, but the prudential regulator APRA was also singled out for being a bit too timid. How do you rate APRA's performance in calling out funds that simply don't perform?
APRA spent way too much of its time focused on trivia and academic stuff that they dreamed up from a position of relative inexperience, frankly, and instead of just focusing on the bottom line. The bottom line has got to be what actually ends up in members' accounts over medium to long-term time periods. You know, if APRA would simply focus on getting rid of funds that are chronic underperformers, that don't heed warnings, then it would be doing a much better job, in my opinion.
APRA's chairman, Wayne Byers, says the regulator doesn't have the powers or the resources to properly supervise the sector, and that the funds it regulates need to provide a first line of defence themselves. Do you buy that argument?
Well, of course, we're the experts at risk management. And what APRA needs to remember is whatever its powers, it spent all of its time running around asking people whether they had enough independence, defined in some really strange way, enough independent directors on their boards, when the obvious question was, well, how come the boards that have representative trustees overwhelmingly outperform? And so APRA spent all of its time advocating for destroying that model or weakening that model.
And that's the retiring chairman of the industry fund manager IFM, Gary Weaven. He was speaking there with Peter Ryan. Scientists say that a shortage of female swift parrots is leading to sneaky sex, where the normally monogamous birds are cheating on their mates. Felicity Ogilvie reports from Bruny Island, south of Hobart, where the endangered parrots are breeding.
When a female swift parrot who is sitting on her nest wants a male to feed her, she gives a particular call. But scientist Diane Stojanovic has noticed the males who answer aren't always her partner.
Basically signalling to the male, if you feed me, we can exchange food for sex. And it seems like from our results, swift parrot females might actually be exchanging food for sex and actually picking out different males to father the children in their brood.
He has found a swift parrot nest in the hollow of an old large gum tree on Bruny Island.
There's four nestlings in here, and the odds are from our study that at least two of these nestlings have different fathers.
He weighs and measures the tiny grey fluffy birds. Then carefully using tweezers, he pulls out a feather to take a blood sample.
Sometimes they give a little squeak because I think it smarts a little bit.
The blood is sent to a lab at the ANU in Canberra for a parrot paternity test overseen by Professor Rob Heinsohn, who has discovered that the parrots are sleeping around. He says sugar gliders are to blame because they have eaten so many female birds that the males now outnumber them 3-1, sending their usually monogamous mating habits haywire.
Now we find there's all these bachelor males who aren't seeing any action in the mating game. And they, you know, vigorously court the females by feeding them, and they press them constantly for sex. And they make a real nuisance of themselves.
abandoning monogamy has been bad for the endangered species.
Maybe males that think their partner is cheating on them spend more time defending their nest than feeding the kids. Or alternatively, males that think that their partner is cheating might invest less in feeding the kids, because what's the point of feeding somebody else's babies?
Each one of these baby birds is precious, considering the scientists estimate that less than 1,000 swift parrots are now left in Australia.
Felicity Ogilvie reporting. Checking finance, it's been another wild ride on Wall Street as investors worry about the outlook for slowing economic growth in the United States. There's also growing scepticism that trade tensions between the US and China are easing despite a supposed truce announced yesterday. The Dow Jones Industrial Average ended 3.1% weaker. Locally, the focus will be on the economic growth results out later this morning. The Australian dollar is lower at 73.9 US cents. That is AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane. It is 8:30.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.